HPPodCraft.com.
The door was locked. My shadow cast a dark blot against its panels, a ghost that wavered drunkenly into the half-light. My hand was perspiring. The candelabrum kept slipping in my grasp. I knocked, listening to the leaden echo it made in the subterranean catacombs of the house. There was no answer. I called, "Cassie!" My tongue felt thick and dry. I waited. "I'm lying down, darling. I've a headache." Cassie's voice was brittly light, controlled with an effort. "I want to talk to you." Anger cut through my tone. For a long moment, there was nothing but the spectral whisper of the waxed candle wicks as they sputtered anxiously. Then, a murmur of footsteps beyond, and the key turned in its socket. I let myself in, closing the door behind me.
That is from the beginning of Chapter 5 of the tale Spawn of the Green Abyss by C. Hall Thompson.
And we're talking about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. We're doing a month of Lovecraft country, whether that's Arkham or the Pacific Northwest or the Jersey Shore like this. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and, of course, on Patreon. We're joined once again by the illustrious Andrew Lehman on the mic.
Yes. Don't forget to check out Andrew's podcast with Sean Branny, Voluminous, covering the Letters of Lovecraft, as well as other issues of Volume. Sometimes they just listen to something and talk about whether they had the volume up too loud or not. They'll look at a big jug of water and guess, how much? What do you think the volume of that is? You know, if you're into volumes of any kind, Voluminous is the show for you. But if you're into Spawns of Green Abysses, this is the show to be listening to right now.
Yes.
Because that's the story we've been reading.
I'm going to do a quick recap, but yeah. I want to know, in what world is this episode the first episode of HP Podcraft that you're listening to? How does that happen? This is a subscriber-only episode, so you must have listened to the one before this.
I like to think maybe there's somebody out there whose entire worldview in terms of entertainment was formed through the experience of seeing Empire Strikes Back. And so they're like, I'm always going to look at the second movie first. I'm always going to have the sequel before the first one.
All right. So anyway, Dr. James Arkwright has been sentenced to death for the murder of his wife, Cassandra, and their unborn child. This story is what he has written, only to be opened after his death because he wants to die. He's a brain surgeon who's married a woman whose dad is a fish man, or was a fish man because now he's dead. She might be turning into a fish woman, and he has just discovered that from her doctor that she's pregnant. Not from her. She didn't tell him. She's pregnant. And now he is kind of mad that he's finding out from the doctor, and he's going to confront her. And that's where we are.
We know that there's some fish man stuff going on. The doctor didn't say, oh, by the way, she's pregnant and also a fish person. He's just seen this green jade kind of hue coming from the both of them. And, well, you know, if you listen to the last episode, you get it. They have gills.
Yeah.
I assumed there'd be some significance to the name Cassandra at some point. Now that I've finished the story, there doesn't seem to be much. You know, the mythological character of Cassandra was always making true predictions that people didn't believe. But as we'll see, once this Cassandra opens up about what's really going on, Dr. Arkwright believes her pretty quickly.
He explains to her, Dr. Ambler told him about the baby, and she says, well, I wanted to tell you, but he's excited and happy at first, but then she gets cold, and she tells him that he's not wanted there.
It's a pretty sad scene, because she does try for a paragraph or two to hold up the lie. Says she traced my lips with her fingertips. I wanted to tell you myself. I did not realize then that the taut sham was still in her voice. I kissed her. Told her it was wonderful. I said all the foolish things a man has a right to say at such a time. And then as suddenly as I'd begun, I stopped. Her mask had slipped. The warm tenderness was gone. It's no good. It's no good. So she just reached that point where she doesn't have the energy to lie anymore.
Yeah. She says, your child. Do you think I'd bear your child? Can't you see I've changed? Don't you know you've lost me, that I belong to him now? Ever since that night I went to the cove, to the abyss, I've always belonged to him, always, always, the bride of Yath-Kala. And then she laughs maniacally after she says this. He yells at her to stop, but she says, it's not your child. You don't believe me? You think I'm crazy? You needn't believe me. Just go away before he comes for me. He said he would come. I don't want him to hurt you. I don't want him to make you like me, like my father. Yath-Kala will come. I will hear his voice. He sings, you hear? Calling me his bride, the mother of his child, I come. Oh, husband of the green void, I come.
It's pretty hot when you read it.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Glad I'm doing it for you. Now, she tries to fight him, but he holds her down, and he notices that there's a fog creeping into the house and over her body.
The stench was something from the bottomless, watery depths of the sepulcher, a vile effluvium that was somehow the embodiment of every malevolent terror that stalked Heath House. I'm a little confused while reading this story, and we could talk about it some more at the end, but it seems that this entity, as she says here, has the power to convert mammals into amphibians, because that's what happened to Lazarus. And she clearly has some monstrous parentage. That I understand, because she's was bred with a fish thing of some kind, but Lazarus was just a guy, so that kind of undercuts the birthing scheme to me a little bit. If you can do it more than one way. I don't know. We can talk about it later.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. I think they try to explain that, whether or not you buy it or not. That's another matter. But
I missed it. So good. I'm glad you are clued in.
She spaces out and then eventually falls asleep. James knows it's time to get to the bottom of this, and he takes the key off of her necklace. That's the key to her father's library, and grabs his revolver. Because now he's ready for action.
Yeah.
And then he goes to investigate, locking Cassandra into the room.
And this was my favorite couple of sentences. That was the night I came to an end of it. You can just take so much. You can go on hoping things will change. That you will awaken from this monstrous dream of falling through a void of unutterable terror. Then, you hit bottom. I genuinely like this moment in the story. First, she stops. I can't do the lie anymore. And then he accepts that ignoring the problem isn't working.
Yeah.
And it feels very true about many difficulties in life where they can stretch on for years and then often get solved one way or another in the space of an hour or a day. You know, once a bottom is hit, the hard decision comes down. But it also made me chuckle because it's such a fairly generalized sentiment until that clause, you know, you will awaken from this monstrous dream of falling through a void of unutterable terror. And then you hit bottom. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It happens to all of us.
Sure does.
That void of unutterable terror phase. But Dr. Arkwright decides, I've hit bottom, he's going to learn the truth, and yeah, like you say, grabs the trusty revolver, but of course you can't fight knowledge with a gun. It says, what I found beyond the massive chiseled portal into the library was a thing that laughed at the puny human bravery of guns, a malignant flowering evil that spawned itself in the pen-scrawled words of a man long since food for the gnawing maggots of an unspeakable hell. Whew! This story is chewy.
Yeah, there's a lot to chew on this one. It goes on to say, I found nothing but a dusty, dry rot-smelling chamber that had been too long without air and sunlight. A moldering, half-burned candle stood at the edge of what Lazarus Heath had used as a writing table. James notices that there is a copy of the Odyssey with a section on the sirens marked off.
When I saw that at first, I thought he had a copy of The Outsiders, which would be quite a different story.
Pony Boy?
Yeah. All the passages with Pony Boy are circled. It's some kind of clue that he's focused on the sirens. But he also sees the books on the shelves and does not enumerate the titles as if we'd heard of them.
Nope.
Instead, he relies on description and suggestion. Says, they were books not meant for mortal eyes, tales told by cults that sank into oblivion before time was measured, cast out from earth, trailing the ruins of their hideous, bloodthirsting rites behind them. So A+ on that one. It tells me way more about what's in there than some awkward Latin title might.
Yeah.
You know, good job. You predicted that we would learn the titles of the books, and you were wrong.
I was wrong.
Yeah, you're the Cassandra in this story. You're the opposite Cassandra.
I'm anti-Cassandra this episode. Yeah. Looking around, James finds Lazarus Heath's diary.
The minute he touches it, he feels the evil of Heath House. The storm pitches up, and he begins to read.
Back in the 20s, Lazarus was the first mate on a steamership called Macedonia, bound for Africa. Things were fine for a while. He had a decent crew, but somewhere near Africa, they hit some serious fog.
I did chuckle a little bit because I think I've said before, if there's a flashback sequence in the last third of a horror story, it's always in the 1920s. Always. They hit this fog somewhere in the southern Atlantic. And it's a quick rendition of the temple or any of the Hodgson mold stories that we've covered. So still this damnable fog, and that's not the worst of it. The instruments have begun to act queerly. We must go on as best we can and trust in the Almighty. Men, very jumpy. It's almost like he knows that we've read those stories before. I can just give quick clips of these diary entries because these guys know where it's going.
So 4 days later, they're still in the fog and lost. Their instruments are going wacky, and then finally they just die. They don't work anymore. There's this young guy called Dyke, and he starts talking about hearing things, hearing voices, and singing. And he's kind of a bookish guy, and he keeps to himself, sensitive type. Eventually, they run out of fuel, and the engines are dead.
It's going to be the guy that gets space madness, the guy that reads a lot.
He is. Still in the fog, the crew starts getting freaked out. Dyke starts saying crazy stuff. You hear them? The voices? I can hear them. They're calling us. The sirens are chanting their melodies of watery death. Zothsira calleth.
He keeps calling me. Cher keeps calling me.
You know, I don't think Trent Reznor ever really did date Cher.
Conquistadors who dated Cher.
Somehow I got it in my head that Trent Reznor and Cher dated for a time, and I went back to check on that, and I think it's completely fabricated.
Of course, it was because of Nine Inch Nails did that Dead Souls cover for The Crow. And
yeah.
The lyric is conquistadors who took their share, but for whatever reason, all of us were singing conquistadors who dated Cher. So that must have gotten into your head.
Somehow, and then it went from, oh, well, Trent Reznor was singing about that because he dated Cher.
If I even hear the Joy Division cover that, I still sing, Cher keeps calling me.
Oh, boy.
Back to the story.
Soon it's just not Dyke. The others are hearing these voices, the singing. Eventually, around noon one day, they think it's noon because it's completely foggy and dark. They don't know what the hell time it is. The ship hits land or something, and it begins to sink. However, everyone is just standing around caught in a hypnotic trance.
Lazarus is the first mate. You know, he's running around trying to get everybody to take some action, but they're just zombies.
The ship goes down with everybody except for Lazarus, lost in the water and the fog. And he floats out in the water for a long time. He doesn't know how long until he feels land under his feet, and then he walks up onto a shore. The fog never lifts this whole time. Eventually, he has the strength to get up, and he finds that he's on this lifeless island, and it's covered with some kind of slime. He finds old dead trees, lots of rocks, and lots of slime. He writes, "One gets the singular, frightening impression that this island had been part of the ocean depths for more years than man could count, and somehow has risen to cause the tragedy of the Macedonia and claim its only survivor, myself."
So a little bit of Dagon. There.
Yeah.
You know, it says earlier that this guy's been in a few shipwrecks.
Yeah.
And this one scared him. That was fun. I was like, what a life. If you can go through a shipwreck and go, ah, it's just Tuesday. That's tough. But, I was wondering while I was reading this how I would like it if I weren't steeped in this stuff. I mean, we keep calling out how obvious these things are, but are they obvious?
Hmm.
You know, because I found myself getting a little impatient. It's a great pulpy and emotional story. I think I'd be into it if I didn't know all the Lovecraft background.
Hmm.
But it's something I just can't know. And I doubt our listeners will know either because they're steeped in this stuff too.
At this point, Lazarus finally hears the voices. Come away to your bride, Zothsira. Come away, away to the queen of the green abyss. Come sail away, come sail away, come sail away with me.
Not even knowing who Zoth... Sara is, or whatever. I mean, if I heard that in the night right now, I might go.
Yeah.
Sounds better than what's going on here. Let's see what kind of deals Osir's got to offer. I don't know.
Yeah, could be a sweeter package. You never know.
Yeah.
Got to check out your options, you know? So he follows the sound of the voices, but he doesn't know where it's coming from. It leads him to the beach, and then he just keeps walking into the water.
He thinks running to the shore is going to help him escape those voices, but the sirens aren't singing from the island. They're singing from the water. Yeah. And he walks right in, which might cause us to think of Splash, as we so often do in these scenarios with Tom Hanks.
Always do.
But I was thinking, this is published in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Woolf in 1941 committed suicide by walking into the river behind her house and drowning herself.
Mm.
Talk about force of will to do something like that. Willfully just walk. She put rocks in her pockets and things like that. But it was clearly because of clinical depression that she did it. But in her suicide letter, she makes a couple of statements that became public. And you know, these were difficult times for everybody in the world because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And debate over her suicide kind of blew up in the media. It got pretty cruel, you know, that this person, the sentiment being, we're all suffering. You know, what a coward. And again, I was just trying to think of context. Would that have been in folks' minds when they were reading this in the literary world? I mean, what significance would all these things take on for the reader in 1946? Lazarus going off into the Atlantic and coming back a broken, changed man like so many veterans.
Yeah.
Was there some kind of foreign bride? Is there that sort of anxiety of the culture clash? And then also that these main characters are doctors and they just can't deal with or understand the mental issues of this man. You know, which might also be speaking to some kind of general anxiety. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Let's keep walking under the water, and then maybe we'll circle back on this as well.
Lazarus walks up to his chest, then his neck, and then finally his face goes under, but he doesn't drown because, check it out, he's got gills.
What?
Where did those come from?
I don't know. Just as with Cassandra, I don't think Lazarus' name is an accident, right? Because he walks into the water and he emerges reborn, resurrected. You know, I think the last name Heath also is a reference to Heath bars, which are delicious, dangerously irresistible. So those two he got right.
Now there is a big space in the diary, some 20 years, and he talks about his experience again, after all that time, about going into an undersea city.
Right, so he picks this up again much later, calling the place he went the Empire of the Green Abyss.
A submarine, slime-choked empire of strange geometrical dimensions, a city whose architecture was somehow all wrong. Sounds very familiar. Real gay. He became one with the creatures that were subjects to Zoth-Sira, the Empress of the Abyss. The things, he could not describe them. He was repelled yet irresistibly drawn to the queen who made him her lover. I was helpless. I was part of those decadent blasphemies and I knew it, yet had not the will to resist. I wanted only to go on listening to that hellish sweet voice which belonged to my queen.
Sometime in one of these stories, they're actually going to describe those decadent blasphemies and monstrous rites instead of just hinting at them. Just once, I want to know what the cultists are up to. What are they doing that's so decadent and blasphemous?
Well, I think there's a whole genre of Lovecraftian fiction that does go into detail about those decadent blasphemies. So if you want to read it, I'm sure our listeners could point out a few of those for you.
Yeah. Why don't you guys go read that stuff? Find some good passages. Send them my way, and I'll judge whether they're decadent or not. I'm just going to have a forum response set up that says, too tame.
So Lazarus becomes Yoth-Zara, the Chosen One.
Yeah.
Good name for a movie. Zoth-Sira had a child with him, a child in his image, and he took that baby and escaped the island. A year and a half later, he was found on the island with the child. Folks wondered about his blue lines on him. And how the heck he was able to survive on an island with no food or shelter for a year and a half? And where did this baby come from?
Yeah, a lot of questions. We heard about those earlier.
So in the journal, Lazarus goes on to explain about his research. He discovered some things or has an inkling.
Says, their race was cast out, as men recorded, but only condemned to the deep they once controlled. So that sullen alone they begat the people of the abyss, a race of creatures that lurks on the edge of time, safe in the maw of the green ocean, until the moment comes when they shall again proclaim themselves and retake the world from which they were banished countless ages ago. This is kind of different because it's like talking about a whole race of peoples rather than one entity with cultists.
Yeah, it's more Deep One-ish than it is Cthulhu-ish. It's more a Shadow of Innsmouth.
I have been one of them. Through me they had hoped to strike, I think. I was to be their contact with the world we know. I have heard their unsatisfied whimpering. They chafe at the bit for release, and I say beware. They have claimed me. True, I escaped, but even yet I am one of them. In the end they shall reclaim me, but not alive if I can help it. So he's a Manchurian candidate. He's a double agent, and that's why they let him go. That's kind of what their plan was. He didn't really escape, I don't think. So it was just luck that the ship crossed that bit of the Atlantic then? Like they were just kind of waiting around for a human to be in the general vicinity, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I don't know.
Or the fog. Somehow they used the fogs to control where they were going to that place, to that island. I don't know. Lazarus worries they are going to claim Cassandra. While James reads this, the storm rages outside. There's no power in the house, and he reads by candlelight. But then he hears singing, and then Cassandra's reply. I have heard you call, O Yoth-Kala, my betrothed. I have seen the spirits of the abyss grow wild as presage of your coming. Their rejoicing has set loose the sea that is their empire. It echoes in the thunder, the black wind and lightning. Come then, my husband and father of my child. Claim your bride. Come to me through the cove of Yoth-Zara, my father. I wait. Come. Come then. Come.
These names are confusing me. So Yoth-Kala is her betrothed.
Yes.
She's engaged to Yoth-Kala, or has a promise ring or whatever. And her father...
Well, she's has this child in her.
Oh, that's Yoth-Kala's kid.
A little bit more than a promise ring. She's impregnated by
that
thing.
That's true. That is a little bit more. Well, no, I grew up in the Quad Cities. We call that a promise ring.
Uh, Oh, boy.
I was worried that there was going to be some incest in here.
I thought there was, too. I got really confused, but fortunately, in one of the paragraphs, they say both Yath-Zara and...
That's right here, yeah. Her father became Yath-Zara. She hooked up with Yath-Kala.
Kala, yeah.
And then he hooked up, her father hooked up with Zoth-Sira. So
yes,
that's the universe there. So these are all individuals. It's not some big entity.
So James rushes over to the window and looks down at the place her father was buried. First, he hears it. Cassandra, I come, O Cassandra, my bride. But then he sees it coming out of the water between those ancient pillars.
I cannot say the thing in the cove walked. It moved inland rapidly, but with a seemingly gradual amoebic motion. It expanded and ebbed, gelatinous tendrils creeping over the sand of the cove, spreading like a stain of ink or black poisonous blood. I saw no distinct form. I was conscious only of a monstrous jelly-like mound, black and glistening with a slime-coated, nauseous putrescence. The thing slobbered onward to Heath House, covering ground with frightening speed. And from this hellish creature, through the whiplash of the storm, shrilled the high, hypnotic voice of Yath-Kala, calling his bride. The period of befogged waiting came to an abrupt end. I knew quite suddenly that the time for thinking and rational disbelief had run out. It was no longer a matter of guessing and wondering at the mad writings of Lazarus Heath. I myself had seen them come to foul, soulless life. I had witnessed the evil of the abyss incarnate creeping relentlessly toward its goal, coming to claim Cassandra.
Whew, gross monster time.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, like in a romantic film, the protagonist often will run through rain to reclaim the love interest at the end. The wetter the protagonist is, the more in love they are. So this guy emerging, you know, Yath-Kala coming out of the ocean soaking wet. This is actually pretty romantic, hearing it that time.
He seems to be really in love with her.
He's really in love.
Clenching his pistol, James runs to the door, but before he gets there, he smells that horrible smell, and he looks down the staircase, and it's already there at the bottom of the stairs.
At the approximate center of this putrid blue-black mass, a raw, slobbering hole, which seemed to be a rudimentary mouth, sucked in and out with obscene rhythm. It was from this opening in the reticulated reptilian hide that the cloying, mucus-choked chant of Yath-Kala emanated. Actually, there was no face, but nearly a foot above the wound-like mouth, there was a single serpentine tentacle that writhed from side to side, sensing rather than seeing, looking like some flesh-made periscope shot up from hell. At the end of the tentacle, I made out what might have been an eye, the squamous, dusky, expressionless orb of a snake. And now, as the thing crawled upward, the eye tentacle suddenly grew rigid, turning toward me. For a second, the huge gelatinous form hesitated, then moved forward again, this time directly for me.
So I played spooky music under that one, but I gotta say, it was a hard call not to put the romantic music under it. Would have worked in a pretty different way.
James is backed up against the wall, horrified by what he's looking at. He can hear Cassandra thumping on the door, trying to get out. At this point, he said he wasn't sure if he shouted or screamed, but whatever he did, the thing then takes focus on him and moves to attack him. It wraps a tentacle around his body, and it begins crushing him. James's hand was in his pocket on his gun, and so he's able to squeeze the trigger, and it shoots through his jacket and into the creature's flesh. This causes the creature to let him go and screech, and then all was silent. James then runs to Cassandra's room, opens the door, and locks it again. Cassandra is in her right mind right now because the creature's not doing its song. It's not using its mind powers, its hypnotism on her. And she pleads with James not to let the thing have her. And he goes, of course, I'm not going to let it have you. We're going to get out of here and we're going to be all right. Everything will be fine. And she says, no, that's not what I mean. You have to kill me. And of course he refuses. And she says, it's true. It's the only way out. If you don't care about me, think about the child, my child by him. Think of the child. I am the daughter of Zoth-Sira. My father was a human. I was born in the image of that father, but think of the child I must bear. Suppose he is born in the image of his father, and that thing out there.
The oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of an ugly baby.
So just then, the singing starts up, and Cassandra gets lost in the hypnotism. She becomes hot to the touch, and her eyes bulge out of her head. She claws at James as she escapes. The door is being pushed up against, and a black feeler comes out from underneath it and touches Cassandra's ankles.
Evil, caressing. Getting down with this girl right in front of him.
So James takes the gun, comes up behind her, and he puts the gun to her temple and pulls the trigger. He says at that moment he expects Yath-Kala to kill him, but it didn't. It screams in pain and anger, and then it leaves.
Yeah, 1 second, though. When he shot the monster before, it did hurt the thing.
Yeah.
There was a smell of seared cloth as a bullet burned through my coat, and then sharply a cry, almost human, a furious pain. Mm-hmm. A slitted, ugly wound opened in the feeler, and bluish, stinking slime spewed over my hand and waist. So it bleeds. You can kill it, perhaps. This was the foul, putrid blood of the creature, a thick, nauseous ichor that spurted like oil. The feeler uncoiled in a tremendous reflex of agony. So I'm just saying, maybe try a few more shots on the monster before killing your wife?
Yeah.
Especially since she seems to be under a spell. Probably there wouldn't have been enough ammo to kill this thing. I was just surprised it affected it at all, because normally guns don't work on these kinds of entities, but it did.
Yeah. It did. It had an effect, sure, but it might not have been enough to kill it, and of course she'd still be pregnant with its spawn, so...
Well, but the kid might turn out all right. That's just an assumption that they're making, that it's going to be a big gelatinous blob. You know?
Yeah, that's true. They are jumping to conclusions.
But this is a way to succeed, you know. He pulled the shoot the hostage move, and the thing went, nothing I want here anymore, so it just left. I did like that because it reinforces that idea that these creatures, they're not vindictive or emotional in the ways that we anticipate.
Sure.
It was there for one purpose, and once that was gone, it doesn't care about killing him. What does that matter?
No. Yeah.
So it just goes away.
He says, I walked back to where Cassandra lay, calm and at peace. I sat down beside her and smoothed her soft, warm hair gently. I think I cried. The storm whispered a last protest and died. I sat there with Cassandra until the late next evening when Dr. Ambler came to call and found us.
They say that prayers help. If you have come this far, if you think you understand the story of Cassandra Heath, you might try it. Make it a very special sort of prayer. Not for Cassandra and me. All our prayers were said a long time since. We are at peace. This prayer must be for you. For you and all the others who must be left behind, who cannot walk with me up that final flight of wooden stairs to peace and escape, who must go on living in the shadow of a monstrous evil of which they are not even aware, and so can never destroy. You may need those prayers. Somewhere beyond the edge of the last lone lip of land, beyond the rim of reality, sunken beneath the slime and weed of innumerable centuries, the creatures of the abyss live on. Zoth-Cyrus still reigns, and the siren songs are still sung. Entombed in their foul, watery empire, they writhe, restless, waiting. This time they have lost their foothold. This time their link with the world of normalcy has been broken, their contact destroyed. This time they have failed. But they will try again. And again.
And that's the end. The warning, the threat.
Yeah. Now, you were talking earlier about their plan or what they had to do, and as I understood it, and I could be wrong, is that Lazarus and the big monster thingy had a baby, which is half human, half monster thingy. Cassandra was impregnated by a monster thingy, so whatever her baby would be 3/4 monster, 1/4 human.
That's true, yeah.
And maybe that's the recipe they needed to get their foothold on the human world.
far be it for me to understand what kind of biology is happening at all anyway, because they are spontaneously making humans able to breathe underwater and have gills. And so if they say this is the way they got to do it, I guess I got to trust the monsters on that.
Yeah. It's, you know, who knows? We can't understand. It's a weird story.
It just wasn't as clear to me. I mean, there were so many layers of it. And when you have the shadow over Innsmouth, there's one layer coming in to get your human women because that's how they do it. And so it's very simple.
Well, not just your human women.
That's right. Yeah. All of them. That's true. That's right. Yeah.
Your human men have to be doing the third oath, if you remember that one.
That's true. Yeah. So everybody, but there's definitely a pretty simple crossbreeding plan going on there. Whereas this one, there were lots of characters I never saw. In my head, anybody that gets a name that lives undersea immediately looks like Merman, the He-Man character. Yes. I mean, it just made them a little less scary that they had first and last names. I don't know. I would say this is a well-written, good pulp story. I really liked it and enjoyed reading it.
Me too.
Used all the Lovecraft tropes. But in Shadow of Innsmouth, I don't know what it is. That story is dripping with shame or something that just makes it a little more effective. There's more going on behind the scenes, I guess, behind the science fiction stuff. Mm-hmm. I can't tell if there's anything else going on in this story besides the typical reabuse of these tropes, you know? I mean, what is it that it's at the core of this? What is the fear?
I don't know.
The characters are a little more fleshed out here. And we'll often, when we talk about these things, reward the author for having put a love story in there or having them be more emotional than the Lovecraft characters. But at the end of the day, even with a little more fleshing out, these guys are just vessels for the horror. They're to be abused, you know? Yeah. Not even Lazarus really makes an active choice of any kind.
No.
He's sucked into it. They're all sucked into it.
In Shadow Over Innsmouth, those people, they make the choices. They're the ones that decide to make deals with the deep ones. They decide to make the sacrifices. Yes. They're the ones that decide to have sex with them.
Right.
And mate with them.
And even the choice, so here the Lazarus goes off because he works on a ship and then falls into this trouble. Our main character in Shadow Over Innsmouth is doing genealogical research.
Yeah.
So it's an invitation, even though that's not something wrong to do, it's connected to the theme of that story, which is uncovering some horrific truths in your own lineage. And so I think that one just works on that deeper level. I do think that when you're dealing with characters in horror, for it to reach that next level, there has to be some kind of hook that makes me feel like I might find myself in that situation. And that's usually by having them make some choices that you could see yourself making, but that you know aren't good ones. Mm-hmm. But also when you're dealing with horror, you can't really fault an author for, it's just a way to go. You either have characters who experience a horrific thing, or you have characters who bring it on themselves.
But you know what's not horrific? Andrew Lehman.
No! So glad to have him back on the show.
Check out Andrew and Sean Branny's awesome podcast, Voluminous, where they read the letters of Lovecraft and talk about a lot of interesting, insightful stuff about the author that we often reference on this program.
And just amazing topics to talk about, too, just the things that come up. It's good to listen to. Check out Voluminous.
I'd also like to thank some of our patrons. First of all, Cypherpunk, thank you.
I'd like to thank Jussi Limitainen.
I'd like to thank Mark Saunders.
Anthony Burke, thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca Svart Silberg.
Scott Morris, thank you.
I'd like to thank Andrew Riggs.
I'd like to thank John Royal.
I'd like to thank Bilbo Baggins.
Oh my God.
Bilbo Baggins. Bilbo Baggins.
Bilbo.
Bilbo Baggins.
I can't believe Bilbo's a patron of this show.
So they get our podcast in the Undying Lands.
I guess so.
That's great.
That's awesome. Well, I finally want to thank James Candelino. Hey, that's a familiar name. Next month, we are going to be covering a novelette called The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. It's a classic that we just haven't gotten around to yet. We would feel bad if we didn't, so we're going to jump onto that one. That was it for this episode. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.